this hour.
Exactly.
Joint Committee on Tax Reform for June 15, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, this morning we're opening a work session on House Bill 2830, and we're going to be, which we will do now, and we're going to be hearing from Dr. Warner and LC to talk about this bill, and especially the Dash 3, which, of course, you know you received last night at 9 o'clock, and you, of course, thoroughly reviewed and notated it by now. And we'll be getting started on that process in public. Dr. Warner, when you're ready. I will note the co-chair will be here. He was held up by a traffic accident on Highway 217. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. Kate Toswell is with me from Legislative Council. And Chris is coming down to join us, too, from Legislative Revenue. So Kate was up late last night putting together the Dash 3. And as Co-Chair Barnhart said, we got it, I think, up a little after 9 o'clock. So appreciate that. We are still going through that and already have a few ideas around the Dash 4. And I'll point out where those are. But that's probably to be expected with a major bill like this. The first thing we put up on the screen was just the overall reform plan we based the Dash 3. There is one thing that's not in there, but it's in our plan. And that is there's no differences in terms of the rates from what you saw on the Dash 2. The 1/1/19 start that we talked about for the CAT, the 0.15 rate for natural resources. I know there's some discussion still around exactly what rate to deal with on natural resources and agriculture. We did put in a slightly different income tax structure. Those rates do appear in the Dash 3. What we did was push down that lowest rate, which in the previous, the Dash 2 had a 4.5%. Now we pushed that down to 4.0. So, and we made the rate structure a little bit steeper, and we bumped up the 6.5 to 6.75. And then the 875 to 88, and then the rest of it would be the same. The 88 would apply to joint income up to 50,000, and then you go to the 9% bracket. The other thing we put in the simulation, we didn't get it into the draft, but we put in the simulation, was an increase in the earned income tax credit from 8% to 10%. So that's part of the revenue impact and the economic simulation that we ran. If you look at the revenue impact estimates, they're all pretty similar and close. The bottom line is from what you saw in the Dash 2. The one thing we did differently here is separate out for you the different funds that are affected by, that are incorporated into the Dash 3. And we'll go through those different sections. But basically what the Dash 3 does is dedicate the CAT money minus the pass-through CAT credit, into a new education fund. And there's some more language around that fund in the Dash 3, which you can see. So the education, the CAT fund is over $2 billion a biennium, and the full bienniums that start in 2021. So those would be dedicated to education spending. We also had in the Dash 2, and we didn't include it in our summary, but we also have applying the CAT to motor fuel sales. So with the application of motor fuel sales, those dollars have to be separated out by Department of Revenue and put into the highway fund. And so that language is in the Dash 3. It was also the Dash 2. I'll point that out when we go through it. But the language, those of you in Senate revenue will recognize it. It was what was put into Senate Bill 156, which was dealing with the corporate minimum. So it'll pull out those motor fuel sales. And you can see we estimate, basically we assume that this would be roughly half retail and half wholesale. So it would be paying at the rate in between those two and would generate about $50 million per biennium. And of course, that growth rate would depend not on the gallon consumption of motor fuels, but on the overall price times the gallon. So in other words, it would adjust with prices. So you can see that the interesting thing about the general fund is it gets the short-term boost from the corporate income tax increase and then also from the repeal of the special pass-through rate, but it then goes negative in those out years because the corporate income tax goes away and all the CAT money goes into the new education fund. So that would be how that would work over time. We also have a simulation for the dash three that's including the earned income tax credit. Pretty minor differences. Again, as we've said, it's comforting when we don't see huge swings in our simulations when we do small changes. And that's basically what we see here is that we actually get a little bit bigger employment impact. And I think that's the ITC working, but also it's the that lower rate going down to 4%. It gives a slight boost there. We were about 2,100 on the employment. So very small change, but still in the right direction. And investment is up slightly more, too, than it was in the dash two. It's up about $39 million. You also see, if you look down on the distribution, the distributional impact on the less than 20,000, still slightly negative, but very slightly negative. And then you have a small positive impact on the overall amount of that. Remember, this is after-tax real income, so it's inflation-adjusted income. So these are not going to be declines in individuals' household income. It's just going to be a decline when you account for the price impact, and that's about 0.15%. So you can see that there's a very small decline on the lowest group. But the next two groups, there's actually a little bit more income. And the biggest reductions overall in real disposable income are at the top end. And again, that's primarily due to the repeal of the special pass-through rate. So I'll go ahead and go through the draft itself.
Any questions on the material so far?
Okay.
Just one. Paul, the change on that closed brought the lower income down to narrow was a result of that 4%, the personal income tax cut. So,
Mr. Co-Chair, it's two things. One is going to the 4% instead of 4.5%. The other is the bump in the EITC to 10%. So it's those two things. Both of those proportionally actually have a bigger impact on that next to lowest group. So they're beneficiaries of that as well.
Thank you. Oh, Senator DeBoer.
Thank you.
Welcome
Mr.
again.
Chair, as a guest. What was the thought of adding the $1,075 plus 9% of the excise over $24,000? Something new where there's now a minimum. I think it goes to 11,065 plus the 9%. It's like on page 2 at the bottom and page 3 at the top.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator DeBoer, those are the tables that are in current statute. And so basically we didn't change the brackets. Those stay the same. What we've done is put those in we put in a new bracket for the 8.8%. If you look on lines 22 and 23, it's over 5,000. That bracket currently goes from 5,000 up to 125,000. So I mean, that's a huge bracket. But what we did was we created a new bracket in between that goes from 5,000 to 14,000, and that's where the 8.8 applies. And the new bracket then goes from 14 to 125. So we kind of wedged in a new bracket in the middle for the 8.8. And then and we reduced the size of the 9% bracket. So instead of going from 5 to 125, it goes from 14 to 125. So the rest of it is just current law calculations. You take whatever that amount is for that prior bracket, and then you multiply the percentage, the marginal percentage above that. So that's just the calculation's the same as we have in current law. It's just we've wedged in that new bracket.
Representative Bueller?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. Paul, what's the rationale for exempting revenue for a specific sector of the healthcare industry if they serve Medicare recipients but not the entire healthcare sector? Why that carve out for the long-term care industry?
There's several carve outs related to the medical sector. They're related also to the what is in 2391, which would be the provider tax. So those are the elements that are not subject to gross receipts. The idea behind the Medicare, Medicaid is that those are, in a sense, a governmental transfer. So they're not directly a governmental entity, but a governmental transfer.
Right. And we will get to more of these items as we get along, but you have a follow-up. Please go ahead.
But why not a medical clinic who serves Medicaid patients? Why is that revenue classified as a receipt, but it's not for the long-term care industry? I don't follow the rationale.
Well, I think the rationale is due to the provisions that are in the 2391. So in terms of the provisions of where those transfers are coming from and how it interacts with overall budget. That's my understanding.
Follow up. I don't think 2391 has, I don't think long-term care industry is taxed, nor do I think physician practices are taxed. So I don't understand why this is relevant.
You've raised a point that we'll continue to review then. Thank you.
Okay.
Shall we go? Let's go on to the next piece. Thank you for bringing that issue to the attention of the committee.
So if we go back to the beginning of the question that Senator DeVore raised about the rates, you can see those are the new rates that are in Section 1, so slightly different. Section 2, again, has the temporary corporate income tax increases. And those are up to 8% and 9%, so that's the same as the Dash 2. Those are in effect for 17 and 18 tax years, and then January 1 of 19, then we go to the income tax rate reduction, so they don't take effect until 1-1 of 19. So the rest of the definitions and are pretty much the same. As you go through that, the Section 4. And then the other key area on page 8, and this is the section that Representative Bueller was referring to, is there's a long section of what gross receipts do not include. And again, that's a section for you to review closely because there are a series of adjustments here. We initially made some changes with respect to Ohio, but then we've been adding things in that section. The main one is you can see the initial ones generally are things like gifts and charitable contributions that are received, but we also have, and under the excluded persons in the prior section, all the nonprofits are exempt. So they can be affected by both of those.
What page are you on now?
I'm just going through page 8 and 9.
I was on the wrong place.
Okay. Yeah, we did see on the bottom of page 11 where an area where we've looked at is the wholesaler in the state, and we did want to change one thing. The last word there on page 11, it says intends. We want to change that to sells, not intends to sell. So that's already a part of our Dash 4. But the idea, again, on the wholesaler is if its final destination is outside the state and there's documentation to show that the final destination of that product was outside the state, then the input supplier of that product to the wholesaler would not be subject to the gross receipts tax. That's trying to get at this where you just have this intermediary in between and there's not really final consumption in the state.
Paul, as you're working on the next version, if you're solid on an errata, could you transmit those to the committee by email and post them so that we can read this version and also include the errata so that members can be up to speed on the next version as it comes?
Okay.
I mean, it's our intention. Senator Hess and I talked this morning. It's our intention to meet Monday morning and hopefully be prepared to work the bill.
Okay.
So that means committee's going to have to burn the midnight oil over the weekend to catch up. And depending upon when you get the dash four to us, they may need the errata in order to compare here. May I just add to what you've already said? This is probably among the most critical part of the entire bill, this section that includes all of these subsections. Getting them as close to right as we can, I think, is really important. It's also very detailed. So, committee members, please feel free to, and I'm going to add work to you, to your list. I apologize. Please feel free to ask staff about what a section means and how it might be drafted differently if you have concerns, and do it soon so that we can be prepared on Monday. Please go ahead.
Okay, the next section 9, again, we talked about this. I don't think we have any significant changes to this section, but this is another critical one because it defines nexus. And you can see that, in particular, it goes through what is a bright line definition, and we borrowed a lot of this from Ohio, but it refers to the level of sales, the amount of property in the state. But if you have, for example, if you have $500,000 worth of gross receipts in the state, then you're subject to nexus. So that's that broader nexus standard that the privilege tax has compared to, for example, the corporate income tax. So we've been asked to look at, try to get a better idea of how many entities now that don't have nexus would under this. Unfortunately, we really don't have any good data. We have the Ohio data, which does use this type of a nexus definition. So we know kind of a total, but in terms of breaking out, you know, what is the marginal or incremental increase from who is not being taxed now, we don't have a good way of getting at that.
Senator Hess?
Paul, this is, thank you. This is the wider net issue that you're talking about, and I think that's really an important part of this whole concept. You were talking to people in Nevada where they passed this 2 years ago, and they say, well, we look north, and we see a state like Oregon. We see a company like Columbia Sportswear, and they didn't pay Nevada taxes before. But now, because Columbia has retail outlets down there, wholesaler, like they do up here, Columbia is paying into the Nevada tax.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't before. And I don't know how much, hundreds of thousands, I don't know what, but every dollar Columbia pays into the Nevada tax system is one less dollar that Nevada-based businesses have to pay, or one more dollar can go into their schools or services. And that's the whole point of this, is it brings in outside money from people who are doing sales into Oregon, proportionately lightening the load for Oregon businesses and for Oregonians.
And I would add too, Mr. Co-Chair, is that, you know, what the decisions you have made historically are that the best measure of economic activity in the state is receipts. I mean, that's what we use for corporate income apportionment. So this is a way of trying to apply that to all businesses that meet that receipts threshold or sales threshold level. So it's a more consistent treatment.
Thank you.
The next section under the rate of taxation, there were some changes, not in the rates themselves, but the biggest change is in the bottom of page 17, which is under section 10, sub 3. In the last version, as you recall, we had if members of a unitary group filing a combined return, if were in multiple sectors, then they would just go to the catch-all sector, the 0.48. What's done here now in the dash three is that those taxpayers that are involved in multiple sectors, it says if they're doing business in sectors in which more than one rate is applicable, they can designate the source of that income. So, for example, you could say that 50% of the income is from manufacturing and 50% is from retail trade. Well, then you'd pay on half of that, you'd pay the 0.35 retail trade rate. The other half, you'd pay the 0.48 manufacturing rate. So that would give those firms more flexibility. Now, they don't, if you have in a combined return, you have entities within that combined return, they don't all get the $3 million threshold. That is that's shared pro rata among all the members on that return. So they have to sum up to $3 million. And so we didn't want to create an incentive to have a bunch of filers just below the $3 million threshold. But again, the rates stay the same. We have kept the minimum at a flat 250 for receipts less than 3 million. And we do have, Chris has some examples that Senator DeBoer wanted us to look at for different C corps, for example, that are how that would interact with that. And we'll talk about that later. You can also see under Section 11, I had mentioned this. This is the Senate Bill 156 language that shows up around the Highway Fund and directs. Fortunately, we'd gone through and done, Mazin did a lot of work with Department of Revenue, Department of Transportation to work out this language, how it would be separated. And it would be the Department of Revenue would have to determine which amount of the CAT revenue gets transferred to the Education Fund and which amount gets transferred to the Highway Fund, and they would be doing that calculation in the as those receipts are coming in, as they identify where they come from,
and that's based on the constitutional requirements.
Yes. Another new section that we add, we've had a lot of discussions around the how to source broadcasting. And so under Section 13, we have gotten some language based on that work that Chris has done with them to define how the CAT would affect the broadcasting industry, given the amount of uncertainty we've had under the personal income tax. So that was separate language based on our experience around trying to define Oregon sales in terms of the corporate income tax and applying it to the CAT. The rest of the section, one of the things we did discuss and maintained in the dash three is the registration procedures, section 17. We've had some discussion of whether this might be able to be done more efficiently with Secretary of State, but kind of our thinking on this is that due to the fact that this is a whole different role here, you have you have taxpayers, and so a separate registration system would help, particularly in picking up those that are not currently meet Nexus standards. They would be required to register. That would be the first step, and so then the Department of Revenue would go through and see, are there certain entities out there that probably should be registered? And basically, what you do is you say, if you expect sales to be greater than $150,000. Then you have to register. And then you can also say what entity type you are, and that would determine your eligibility for the credit, for example. Okay. The last thing I'd mention is the language on page 29 that starts to get at the Strategic Education Strategic Investment Fund. You can see there's more language in here that was not in the earlier edition that goes through showing how the fund is to be used, its purposes, and an intent statement that's included under the in that section that's new, what we saw before. And of course, you saw the numbers. Well, all the CAT revenue will be flowing in that net of the pass-through credit. So that's where we are, and I will put the things that I mentioned, some other things that we're already aware of, and to send that to an email to the committee here today.
Senator Hass?
Thank you. Dr. Warner, we had that special session for the Nike expansion in 2012. I was just wondering if you could, and I know this does, it's all sales and doesn't change what they wanted, but do we need to update that or put in transition language to keep that that deal with Intel and Nike consistent?
Mr. Co-Chair, that as we've said all along in our discussions about this, the CAT with a focus on a destination approach is very consistent with the single sales approach to apportionment. So I don't think there's any issue there in terms of kind of the general concept. But it is, you are, it is a definitely a different structure, because instead of taking Water's Edge income or Water's Edge income plus tax haven income and then apportioning it back based on sales, what you're doing under the CAT or this type of privilege tax is you're directly estimating the amount of receipts in the state. So it is a different structure. So in that sense, it is, we are going to something different than the environment in which the agreement was made, but conceptually the base is very similar.
So if I could follow up, should we clarify that? Would that be prudent?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, I think that's a policy decision, but something certainly that could be looked at legitimately and should be considered, yes. Okay, so that's where we are in Dash 3. As I say, I will get when we some of the changes we know coming for the Dash 4, I will alert the committee on those. I had one other piece to share with you, and this was really from a question from the last meeting that came up from Representative Nose. And it has to do with the, with something we looked at going way back to the beginning of our discussion around the overall business tax, business taxes in Oregon, how they compare with total taxes. And what we have relied on for our base is the Council of State Taxation study. And remember that Oregon is relatively low in that study in terms of percent of taxes that are business taxes. And also percent of gross state products. So what we did was update those numbers based on the two systems that we're looking at. One is the bridge system for 17 and 18, and the other is the kind of the long-term system that would go into place in 1920 when the cap comes in, 19-20. Just to remind you, of we do a couple of adjustments on the cost analysis. They have a their taxes as a percent of the private sector gross state product. We just use overall gross state product to give a broader comparison. But we also, we do use all these other numbers that we have in the first block here for Oregon under current law for FY14-15. These are all taken directly from the cost study. And you can see, and the gross state product is annually produced by Department of Commerce. We don't forecast it, but it's a valuable piece of information for us because it also has value added by sector. So you can see Oregon's gross state product's a little over $200 billion, and business tax is about $6.7 billion in 14-15. Total tax is 17.9, so about 37% of Oregon's taxes or business taxes are state and local taxes, which is 3.3% of gross state product. So if you look at our neighbors, Washington, as we've talked about before, has a relatively high reliance on business taxes. They have a their retail sales tax is, as we've talked about, is over 40% assumed to be business to business. So that boosts their number. And then they also have, of course, the B&O tax, which is all business tax in these calculations. California, you can see, has a relatively low business tax share. They have a relatively high dependence on the personal income tax. Not as high as ours, but relatively high, and that's what lowers their business tax share. One thing I should remind you, too, is that, and this comes into the calculations about the new systems, is that the there is a factor in the cost study to try to pick up pass-through income that's reported in the personal income tax. And for us, we think it's roughly 8 to 9% of the total personal income tax collection. So that is embedded in these numbers. Then you can see Idaho. Nevada has a relatively high reliance on business taxes because they, of course, get a lot of their revenue from their gross gaming receipts tax, which is really a tax more on tourists than really on business, but it's paid by the businesses. And these are numbers before the commerce tax came into play, so they're probably going to get boosted from that. So again, you can see where the U.S. average is about 44% and Oregon's about 37%, and the average is 4.1% of gross state product at the national level. The FY17-18 system, basically the two changes that you're looking at would go directly into business taxes. That's the corporate income tax increase and then also the elimination of the pass-through special rate. So those both get added into the business tax calculation. And you can see that boosts it from 37.4 to 38.2% and increases it about a tenth of a percent. It's a lower $200 million. So it's only about a tenth of a percent of $200 billion. And then the 1920 system, we have some reductions actually in the personal side. So those are built in. And then you have the floor pass-through rate, which is permanent in that proposal. And then you also have the CAT. And we assume all the CAT is calculated as a business tax, even though ultimately, clearly a portion of it will find its way into higher consumer prices. So this isn't final incidence. This is just who's paying the tax. And you can see the percentages there. Business taxes go to 40% of the total taxes, again, compared to 44% nationally. So that's kind of where we think we would be on the cost study if these changes were made. Of course, we're assuming everybody else stays the same, which they rarely do. So, in this world. All
right. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, one of the factors that I think has been missing in these comparisons of business tax rate is the personal income tax rates in these states, too, which vary pretty dramatically. And obviously, for some businesses, that's where they pay their taxes on the personal side. I'm just doing a little search here. For Ohio's top rate, I think, is 5%. There's a big difference between 5% and 9.9, I guess, on the pass-through side. And I think that's what we're hearing from some of those corporations who will continue to receive their income on that side. They're going to pay a higher percentage than other states. And so it is a factor. If you try to come to some apples-to-apples comparisons here, it really would be helpful, I think, if we also include the whole tax structure for these states and not just focus on business taxes.
Okay. Representative Johnson, we do have the portion in business taxes that are estimated to be from business taxes, but you're right, the marginal rates and the economic theory tells you that's one of the key factors in decisions. We did, several years ago, do a research report on the competitiveness of the state. And we worked pretty closely with the OBA at that time, their tax experts, and got some really good input from them, as well as looking at the detailed tax comparison studies. And I think the conclusion from that was, particularly if you're a manufacturer locating a plant here, we're very competitive with a single sales factor, especially, and no sales tax. But where you did see the biggest pushback would be if you have, high-salaried executives, for example, so that labor is paying directly those taxes, but that's a factor in business location because it ultimately would end up, they would have to pay higher wages because of that in order to be competitive. And then, of course, as you say, the pass-throughs. So that was something we definitely identified in that study.
Did I understand you to say that the pass-through to the personal income tax is considered in these numbers? Did I understand
Mr.
that correctly?
Mr. Co-Chair, yes. The totals are added in there. Mm-hmm. Cost has their method of doing that. So we use that, and then we also just assume that the business pass-through tax, business pass-through rate, which is repealed, we put all of that in our business tax adjusted numbers. Which is about $130 million a year.
So is it fair to say then that this is your attempt at having an apples and apples comparison?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. It's our attempt.
Thank you. Somebody down here.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, the question is whether it's a sour granny apple or a nice sweet, you know, gala apple. Paul, could you, for the record, just define what is in business taxes in these calculations?
Yes.
The question came up of personal income, so on and so forth. And
yes, and I would be happy to send the cost study to everyone as well. But if you think back on that study, it defines the biggest part of business taxes nationally, state and local biggest business taxes, is the property tax. That's about 36%. And general sales taxes on business inputs are about 21% nationally. So, I mean, that's where you see the big difference between Oregon and other states, because we don't have that 21%. Corporate's about 9.5% corporate income tax, and the cost includes the CAT and the B&O, the commerce tax, are all included as a business or the corporate income tax in this study. So they don't make that distinction. The excise taxes are about 5.7%. Unemployment insurance is about 6.5%, and that's an area where we have relatively high taxes. Individual income tax on business income is about 5.5% nationally. So for us, it's going to be about 8 or 9% of our business taxes.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So it's really what's in the taxes is it's the classification of taxes and tax law and what categorized as a tax under the U.S. code and the Oregon code. And it does not include, for example, fees. Let me give you two examples. I have farms in both Oregon and Nevada, and I have one fee that in Oregon that I think is $650 a year, and the exact same fee in the state of Nevada is $15. And then I have a second set of fees in the categories where I think it's $86 per year here, $87 per year here, and $10 in Nevada. And well, actually, since I have property and have had in Washington, Senator, the category is the same thing. So what my point is I think what you just said is that the fee for service category, which of course is two-thirds of the budget, whereas general fund is one-third of the, or it's basically our other fund's budget, which is the fees, is twice as large as our general fund. And so in this category, in this study, what we're really telling you is taxation policy under the law, correct?
Mr. Vice Chair, that's correct. These are taxes. And most of this data that the cost is working from is census data. And census has a category. They have taxes. And we are relatively low in our reliance on taxes compared to other states, one of the bottom five, the last I looked, in percentage of general revenue. But where we're high is on what are called charges. And we're a top 10 state. I think seventh was the latest in per capita charges compared to the national average. So we have a relatively high reliance, but the biggest charge or fee is tuition. And there's also in part of the medical sectors involved there, too. But it would also include those fees that you're talking about. And, yes, we have seen historically, and really some of it dates back to the structural change we've seen from property tax initiatives, a shift toward fees in funding state and local government in Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Noticeable trend.
Thank you. That was a major decision made by the legislatures in the 90s trying to respond to Measure 5 and Measure 50, was it not? Increasing fees, reducing general fund application to the issue, kinds of things that Senator Boquist raises, and a bunch of others.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, a lot of it was around the resource agencies, agriculture, forestry, parks, recreation, where you would shift, that were more general funded prior to 91, and those shifted out of the general fund, more fee-based.
All right, thank you. Representative Boquist, please. I'm sorry. Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair.
Two B's.
Yeah, we don't even
all
look
the
alike.
Same.
We don't even look
Republicans
alike.
With B's. It's
that's right.
And mustache.
Paul,
yeah. Paul, I'm real concerned about the effects this tax would have on small businesses, and compared to large C corporations that are vertically integrated. Am I understanding this right that small businesses would essentially be facing double jeopardy with the taxation both of the corporation and eventually the pass-through income combined with the pyramiding effect puts them at significant disadvantage compared to large vertically integrated C-corps.
Representative Bueller, Mr. Co-Chairs, there is some risk certainly in terms of the amount of transactions can affect the effective tax rate through the pyramiding process. Of course, that interacts with a decision about the threshold, and I think that's been one of the key factors behind looking at a 3 million threshold versus a 1 million in Ohio. But that's a part of it. But also, I think it's important to keep in mind that for large corporations that are, you know, in the $1 billion or more in terms of receipts, we still think they're going to, there's only, based on the Ohio numbers and translating into our estimates, there's about 25 of them, and they would pay about 24% of the total tax. So you still have the large corporations are paying a relatively high amount of the overall gross receipts tax. But you do, I think, have more risk of pyramiding for the smaller businesses that are at the low end, particularly as they start to get up above the threshold. But again, the notion behind the threshold is to protect those. And remember, the threshold, it sets where the rate comes in. So if you have 4 million in receipts, then you only have a million that's subject to the cat and the plus the 250. So all of those are kind of policy tools to try to address that. But yes, I think that is a risk.
Thank you. Senator Bershiger, and then Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Dr. Warner, I've heard many conversations that this package isn't going to affect small businesses, but I don't think that's simply true because we're going to be backing out the small business tax rate, and I think that's any business that is up to the cap, $3 million, will see a 30-35% tax increase right away. Is that not true?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Bertschiger, yeah, I think the short answer is that it will, as always with tax policy, it will depend on the circumstance of the individual business. We know that based on 1 year's data, who was using the pass-through rate. So there will be certainly businesses that will be affected by that. Its usage was not extremely widespread in that first year. Maybe it's increased since. As you recall, Chris went through and looked at that data. That would be a change from where they were certainly the last couple of years and going back to where those businesses were prior to the 15 tax year when it first came into play.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
So that could be somewhere in the neighborhood of 30-35% increase instantly.
When we looked at the overall size of what we think the pass-through rate is now compared to what the what pass-through income is for partnerships and S-corps, we think that the $130 million annual estimate we have now is about 25% of that total. All right? So 25% of what that pass-through income is. So in other words, they got a 25% reduction as a result of that implementing that policy. And we think, you know, where they are right now.
And if we had not passed the special tax break in 2013, these numbers would be pretty flat, wouldn't they?
Yes.
This is a restoration, really, in one sense.
Right.
Of the rate that they were
paying going
before.
Back to the pre-2015 distribution. That's right. Correct, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Hernandez and is it Boquist? Yeah. Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bueller. I mean, I did the same thing.
I don't think we look alike, so don't worry.
Barnhart. Bees.
He's better looking than him.
I got a comment and then a question. It's the stashes. A comment and a question. I guess it would be nice to define what small business means because small business in my district looks very different from somebody else's small district definition or small business definition.
Mm-hmm.
What is the cost of the CAT credit and the wholesale exemption, if you have that?
We have, Representative Fernandez, co-chairs. If you look on our revenue impact sheet, we do have the impact of the CAT credits, the second row there. It's 50% in the first year, 2019, and then we go to 25%. But again, this is, we've designed this so it is a credit that's is taken at the entity level. So what we're envisioning here is you would do your CAT, if you're a pass-through entity, you'd do your calculation of what your CAT is. You take your $3 million, pay your minimum on that, and then your CAT above that. So you do your calculation. Then there would be a line below that would say if you are an eligible entity, you may take a 50% or 25% credit, and you would take that, and that would come right out of your CAT liability. So you would pay after the credit. That would be what your liability is. So it's about 25%. If you look at kind of the proportion of the CAT that's paid by pass-throughs, it's about 25%. So looking at 1921, for example, it's 2.557, about 25% of that is paid by the pass-throughs. And then they get a 25% credit. So that's another 6.5%. So they're paying about 18% of the total collections. And the other 82% are paid by the C Corps.
Let's see, I think Senator Boquist first, and then I have two more. Okay, please.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher. I just want to clarify three things that members said so that we have them on the record. The first is that the 2013 definition, which generates the $282 million on that slide right there, so everybody knows, was active small businesses with active participation from MAMLE members. We specifically excluded passive sitting on the bench watching. So these are your Main Street family businesses in which they are participating, and if somebody's not participating in it, they're not supposed to get part of this $282 million that's right there. That will be repealed under this bill for 2013. That having been said, it is just ironic that we're discussing that we should ensure that we save Nike and Intel because we had a special session and gave them a tax deal, but we should throw the small businesses underneath the bus. Now, just for the record, I did support the Nike and Intel side, and so I'm happy honoring our obligation to that, and I'm just as happy honoring some sort of obligation to the other half at the same time, but I just want to make sure that we have clarification that we did make two deals, not one, and we're sort of honored in some fashion to take care of those two. And I do appreciate my good colleague to my left, in attempting to do that and taking actions to do some of that clarification for the second deal, the 2013 deal. So now it's your turn.
If you remember that special session, that what Nike wanted was to make sure the structure doesn't change. And in exchange for that guarantee, they would guarantee an expansion at their site in Washington County and add 500 new jobs. That was the deal. Since then, they have added 2,900 new jobs. And if you drive out there, you see giant cranes up in the sky. So I think that worked out pretty well for everybody.
Senator Berkshire.
Don't disagree.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Well, Dr. Warner, currently the threshold is $3 million in this scheme. Is that correct?
Yes.
But if this legislature passes this, could not future legislatures broaden that base, move it from $3 million to $2 million or to $1 million, or just eliminate it all with a simple majority vote?
Both go to $5
million.
Members of the committee, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, I'm Kate Toswell from Legislative Council, Chief Editor and Special Counsel, Senator Bertschiger, and Chair Barnhart. My understanding is if it is simply a matter of modifying the base and reducing the lowering the threshold, currently in this dash three amendment, it's $3 million. If the only change were to lower the threshold, we believe that that would be require only a simple majority vote of both chambers. I would caution, however, that there may be other factors in play that would lead us to think that it actually is a bill for raising revenue. I would also caution that at this point, we have a recent case from the Oregon Supreme Court, which is City of Seattle, that gave us further guidance as to what a bill for raising revenue is. Prior to that, we had Bobo versus Kulongoski, which gave us some information looking just at City of Seattle, which clearly one line in the opinion was that the repeal of an exemption is not a bill imposing a tax and therefore is not a bill for raising revenue. So basing our understanding today on that, I would say that it would require only a simple majority. But again, I would caution if there's further developments in the court, in the courts, specifically in the Oregon Tax Court and in the Oregon Supreme Court, or if there were other factors at play in the legislation or in the facts of the case, we might have to revisit that conclusion.
And Mr. Kocher, I would just add another bit of caution. Speaking just from our standpoint, not being lawyers, we don't have a great record of predicting what the Supreme Court will do.
It's like the economist predicting the economy in the future.
That's right, yeah.
All right. Thank
yes.
You.
It's humbling.
We have
yes.
to have more simple points.
Senator Hass, please.
Thank you.
Take me off your list.
What you just said, Kate, would be true whether we pass this bill or not. I mean, broad the base anywhere. There's a multitude of taxes and fees. And so what you just said remains factual. Regardless of whether this bill moves. And second, just so you could clarify, it's different on the rates in a bill like this, correct? That does require more than a supermajority.
The chair has members of the committee. One thing we are clear on is that an increase, not a decrease, but an increase in a rate of taxation with an existing tax is going to constitute a bill for raising revenue and is going to require a three-fifths of both chambers.
Thank you, Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. Paul, have you done a calculation of the tax incidence of this scheme in terms of who actually pays it, buyer, sellers, individuals, businesses?
Representative Bueller, if you look on our simulation, this is a final incidence analysis. So we do it by our 9 income groups. But these, as I said earlier, these are not dollars and cents paid by these income groups. These are the net effect of wages. And you notice that wages are down here, so that's part of the impact. Prices are up, that's part of the impact. So, and this is where, you know, one of the old sayings in tax incidence theory, and you know, we talk about business versus households. Well, businesses don't pay taxes. Individuals do in some way. Either they're equity owners of the business, they own capital, or they own natural resources, or their labor, or their consumers. So in one of those forms of economic activity, the tax will get shifted onto you. So this is a breakout of what we think will happen to prices and wages and how that will be distributed among the income groups. One thing, too, I'm going to add, Representative, is that we will, you know, we're trying to look at kind of a more kind of a general way of looking at what are the proportions in terms of we have the initial change, how much of it translates into consumer prices, how much to wages, how much to real effects, how much is shifted to other states. So we're working on some estimates for you on that, and that might help too with that question.
Yeah, that's a key item when you get to it.
Just a clarification.
Yeah.
So would it be possible, because we hear, you know, the stories about Columbia Sportswear paying X into Nevada, and that all sounds good. But can you give me a percentage of what individuals versus corporations will pay with regards to summarizing that slide, just a percentage?
I think he just told us that he's going to produce that. Did I misunderstand that?
Well, I think there's two things there. Yes, we will look at how that proportion is spread among those different impacts and prices, wages. But in terms of the corporations, as I said earlier with the CAT, then we're back to who's paying initially on the tax, and we think about 75% will be paid by corporations, and about 25% by the other entities. So, of course, the final incidence will be determined what do they do once they get paid that. Some of it will go on to stockholders. It will be exported outside the state for corporations. And some will end up in higher consumer prices that the low-income folks will actually end up bearing the burden.
Right. So that,
and some the feds pay, don't they?
Some, and well, before we input the CAT static numbers into our model, we take out 25% for federal deductibility. Because whether you're a pass-through or you are a C-Corp, you can take, that's a state and local tax as a business expense.
Well, as you prepare that report, if you would include that federal 25% in those numbers so we get the accurate picture of the whole thing, that would be really helpful.
Yes, and what we do have on our report, it's a small number here, is the federal tax paid by Oregonians. You'll notice that it goes up slightly. That's from the income tax reductions. So part of our income tax reductions we lose to the feds, but we get a much bigger chunk of the CAT because that's a business tax that's deductible.
Did you have a follow-up, Director Ambulin?
Would it be safe to say, Paul, as an estimate at this point, that at least 50% of this tax would be paid, with the incidence would fall on individual taxpayers?
Mm-hmm. Representative Buell, I don't think it's that high. I think it would be, I think you're going to have, you've got 25% that's exported initially through the federal return, and we estimate about, I believe it's about 19%, it was on one of our sheets we gave you, 19% of the remaining share is exported through to non-residents, through people coming into the state, paying higher prices, commuters paying taxes when they come in. Through the CAT indirectly, and then the out-of-state firms. So that's about 19%. There's 44%, and the rest would be divided among the price impacts and the wage impacts and what we call real impacts, which would be a reduction in output. And that's primarily captured through the employment, but in this case, we don't have employment losses. So the other two components would be the wage reductions on labor and then the price impacts on households. So those would be the two components. And so we'll work those out and give you some our best estimate on that.
Thank you. Representative Marsh, please.
And of course, this discussion of impacts really brings us sort of full circle back to the question of outcomes, which is one that is difficult for us to always put some numbers attached to. But what we do know is that generating additional public sector investment has specific outcomes for families who are involved in our healthcare system and our education system and our transportation system. While we are focused up here on the numbers, I think we cannot lose sight of the long-term investment impact of all of this.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Marsh. Yes, and we did have one of the attendees at our public hearing gave us a good citation of a recent study in a major economic journal that estimates some of those productivity impacts we talked about from education. And we'll post that out on OLIS for the committee.
Thank you. That would be helpful. Yes, Representative Marsh, follow-up?
Well, it's not a follow-up, but I actually had one second question.
Please.
Which is, of course, I wasn't sitting up here when the pass-throughs were agreed to a couple of years ago, but I was sitting in the audience in December when you gave us an analysis of the first year usage of those pass-throughs. And my recollection is that they were predominantly associated with pretty high-income households. And I'm wondering if you could provide that information again out to many of us who maybe weren't part of the dais last time.
Okay.
Co-Chairs Hass and Barnhart, Representative Marsh, Chris, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. Certainly, Representative Marsh, we have that information. And just off the top of my head, that the dollar impact and the number of claimants were highly focused on taxpayers over $200,000 of income or $500,000 of income. I did put together different tables, and it's in OLIS somewhere, and I can certainly, we can load it up for this committee.
Be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator DeBoer, please.
Thank you. There's 30,000 C-Corps in Oregon. What we're doing is repealing their tax completely and adding a new tax. there's 400,000 small businesses in Oregon. I want to be real clear that that $3 million exemption, that a small business pays their tax on the personal tax side. Every one of those small businesses will have an increase in this, period. And if they think they're going to exclude under the $3 million, what they're going to do is their continue same tax rate they have on profits will go through on their personal return. Then they will also pay the cap tax. If they exceed the $3 million, they'll pay $250. Those that are currently filing a S or an LLC, in our comments and from people, I urge everybody to go to the comments. There's one from RRESA, which is Eric Fruits, because I've been waiting for somebody to show me I'm wrong in my numbers, and his comments exactly duplicate what I see in this. And I've asked to have a sample, and I think you have that in the screen, and I think it'd be a good idea to bring it up. So.
So now we're on to the next topic. Thank you.
Good.
That was one of the topics that they were planning to cover this morning.
Yes. This is kind of a continuation of what Chris has been doing and looking at examples. And, of course, you know, there's a lot of potential examples. And Senator Bohr asked us to look at some specifics around the threshold and some other situations. So this is what Chris has put together.
So what we have here is five examples. We have two C corporations and three S corporations. And the key theme here is the amount of gross receipts. So we have anywhere from $3 million to $35 million. The key difference between the C corporations and the S corporations is that the C corporations might be considered high margin businesses. In these examples, they're 30%, and the S corporations might be considered low margin. So that's the theme difference. So walking through them, the first one, the C corporation, $2.9 million in gross receipts at a margin of 30% means taxable income of $870,000. So the next two columns here are either their corporate or their personal income tax, however the business gets taxed. That's what the committee's been talking about, the C corporation tax rates or the pass-through entity tax rates. For this one, it's a C corporation, so they're subject to the 6676 rate. Their tax would be $57,420. And that's the effective tax rate of 6.6%. Under a 0.48 cat, because they're under the $3 million, they would be paying the minimum tax, and that's $250. Mm-hmm. So it's a tax reduction of $57,170 for this particular example.
Why do you want to stay under three?
Now for the next one, the C corporation at $8 million in gross receipts. Taxable income goes up to $2.4 million. Their corporate tax is $172,400. That effective rate is 77.2%. Most of that income, the first million, is taxed at 6.6, and then above that, it's taxed at 7.6. The 0.48 cat would be a tax of $24,250 for a tax reduction of $148,150. And this is some of the feedback we've been getting about certain C corporations. If the assumptions are correct, they could see a tax cut. Now moving to some pass-through entities, we have three S corporations. Each of them has $35 million in gross receipts. The first one has a 2% profit margin, so their taxable income is $700,000. Their PTE tax, that's the pass-through entity tax rate, is $50,700, and so that effective tax rate is 7.2%. And the 0.48 cat would be $153,850. So the difference here is $103,150. It's important to keep in mind that for the S corporation, it's not a swap of the taxes. So the next S corporation, we have a 5% margin, and the arithmetic pretty much works out the same. Their taxable income is $1.75 million. Their pass-through entity tax is $133,500. And their cat, the 0.48 cat, is $153,850. And these are all going to be the same because it's a function of $35 million. So their cat is $20,000 higher. But again, they would be paying both of these. And then the bottom one, we have an S corporation, 8% margin, taxable income of 2.8. The PTE rate would be $220,500. And then the 0.48 cat is $153,000. So that one is a this simple comparison, it's a tax reduction going from that. I haven't fully incorporated going from the PTE rate down to the repeal of the those rates. This is just a simple comparison of the income tax and the cap tax.
And does it include the credit?
As usual, the examples are hopefully informative but not complete. I haven't incorporated all of the pieces yet.
So if you included the 50% credit, some of these numbers would change quite a bit, wouldn't
right.
they? Another question I have, it seems incredible to me that an advertising firm or a market research firm would keep that kind of money in the corporation, because when they do take it out later, it's subject to double taxation under federal law. Are these contrived examples, or are they based on something real? I mean, those seem very unusual to
Coach me. Coach Barnhart. So I've done this enough, so, and even with a state the size of Oregon, almost any example we can come up.
Somebody's
can
done
exist.
It. Right.
The trick with any example is how representative it is, and I think that gets to your question. So what, to try and answer that question, I was looking at C Corporation tax return data for companies with less than $3 million and those that pay the minimum tax versus the rates. And in the tax year I was looking at, there are about 25,000 C Corporations with less than $3 million in Oregon sales. And of those 25,000, there were about 50 of them that had taxable income above $1 million. So using that as a rough proxy, it's 50 companies out of 25,000. So it is an extremely small percentage. And without getting into the, without actually like going over to DOR and looking at the return and verifying all of that information, that's the extent I can comment on that, because any situation can possibly arise. It can be some sort of data error even. And it can be unique circumstances. And this is a one-year snapshot.
Right.
More interesting would be how that plays out over time. But
there might be another kind of business other than an advertising firm and marketing research firm that mostly professional wages are being paid to right. as expenses. Some other kind of firm that also has very high margins that could end up with this example. So if we change the label, it might actually be realistic.
Correct. The labels are somewhat decorative.
I mean, you would think that the principals would pay out pretty much all the income to themselves in wages so as to avoid double taxation for this kind of a firm. Senator DeBoer, did you have something else on this topic? I've sort of taken it over.
If you look at that study by Eric Fruits, and I'll actually email it to every one of you, it's a very distinct report that shows the fallacies of what happens in this, and I certainly I like the plan, the interim plan, but tying it to this gross receipts, I think with the short period of time we have, this is so complex, and looking at our ability to collect taxes, which we are very poor at, I think there's $3 billion of uncollected taxes, that our department that does that will be incapable of keeping up with the changes this will create.
And we'll ask them for input on that question on Monday. Senator Hess, please.
Thanks. I just want to go back to, we can speculate or do scenarios from extreme sides to say this and this, but one thing that's not speculation is this $3 million threshold. 92% of the business filers in the state will not be affected by this tax, period. Not speculation, that's not a scenario, that's by design, and it's factual.
I think you got a head nod. Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to briefly bring in just comment about both what Representative Marsh said as well as Senator DeBoer, is with all due respect, I have seen other studies by Mr. Fruits where he proposed, for example, that a way to solve our budget situation was to just kick all those people off Medicaid because that would have no residual impacts. And so I want to bring in between that perspective and Representative Marsh's comment about there are other residual benefits that come to this in the increased funding of education, human services, et cetera. So just the reminder to always look at the broader perspective and not just stick with the economists who only have two opinions because they have those that many hands.
Thank you. There's a couple more questioners, but I want to find out whether we have gotten through the list of things you plan to cover today. If you have, we'll go on to the other questions.
Yes, I think we have.
You have. Okay. Senator Bershiger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You know, I'm just going to reiterate what I've said a couple times on this committee, is that any time you make major changes, the companies are going to change their behavior. It's that simple. I'm not saying that you didn't do a good job on your projections. I'm just saying this is a perfect example. What you go back, Chris, to what you just had. This is a perfect example of why I know that the businesses are going to change their behavior. You can manipulate your business to take advantage. All you got to do is look at that board, and you can see winners and losers. As a businessman for over 40 years, I'm going to manipulate my business, change the way we do business, to benefit from this scheme. I will figure a way to do it.
Right, and of course, that's precisely the reason to go to sales as a way of considering of calculating the tax, because it's one less level of complexity as compared to income, which allows for much more manipulation than this process does. But your point, of course, is very well taken. Representative Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Co-Chair. Paul, what's the rationale that's going into determining the level of the pass-through credit? Because we've seen some evolution with that throughout our process here. At one point, I think we started out at, I don't know, 0.5, and then we went to 0.43, and now we're at 0.5 for the first biennium, but then it goes down to 0.25. What's responsible for those changes, and why is 0.25, I guess, the good number going forward?
Representative Johnson, Mr. Co-Chair, ultimately the short answer is a policy issue, and that's a lever in terms of part of the entire package. As I think I mentioned to the Joint Committee last week, the initial target was around the recognition of the special pass-through rate, and that was going to be a change and to provide some broader relief to those entities because of that effect. So that was the general target, and you can see that, and I think the other rationale for going to the 50% initially was to smooth the transition into the new system where there has to be adjustments, and some of the adjustments that Senator Bershiger is talking about in terms of business behavior. So that was the idea, as kind of a phase-in part of it to provide a cushion in that initial year. And then the 25% is a way to, as I say, what that does is reduce the share of those entities, those pass-through entities, from about 25% to about 19%. So I don't think there's a magic number there, but it's a way to reduce their net proportional impact. I think one of the most difficult things about this issue, and this has really come up with this proposal, is that, you know, so much of, you've seen an evolution of these entities and the way they're taxed relative to C-Corps over time. And so if you stop at any point in time, you've got different treatment going in. So it always depends on where you start from. And, you know, we've heard, and I think Co-Chair Barnhart has mentioned this several times, that I was taught way back when I was learning economics, was that, you know, corporations are taxed twice because the dividends are taxed. So it's an unfair element of the tax system, and that was long a criticism. So, and I think the pass-throughs developed partially in response to that. And so now we see that the kind of the playing field we're at now, where you have different tax treatment, and we're starting from a point where those entities are treated differently.
Oh, and then I appreciate that, but I guess along with that, we're seeing some decrease in the lower end on the personal income tax side, which I think is an acknowledgement that there will be higher costs that will impact those folks disproportionately, right? But I would say along with that, you know, if there is sensitivity to the impact on small business, that credit on the pass-throughs could also be modified, provide a little more relief there as well, correct?
Yes. Representative Johnson, yes. The relief on the low end, two things. One is we see some of the positive employment impacts you get from the labor force effects, but also because of the upward pressure on consumer prices that which is ultimately a consumption-based tax, will have. So it's a recognition of that. And certainly in terms of the pass-through credit or any of these levers, those are things for the committee to decide, for the legislature to decide their policy levers.
Senator Haas, before we lose the rest of the committee, there's some announcements and a little bit of talk about where we headed from here. Senator Haas?
Thank you. I know, Paul, we're going to put together another amendment to fine-tune this, change intends to sell, and specify the education measure. But there was also some discussion in recent weeks, and I've been visited by people in, from the agriculture industry about exempting ag altogether. And so, and I know there's some difference of opinion up here. Surprisingly, so when we do that amendment, could we have one with the ag exemption and one without, and we'll decide on Monday. I hope that's not too much. Mm-hmm. Just extended your weekend into the Sunday hours now, Kate. I think.
Mr. Gocha, that could affect our copying budget, though.
Right.
Given the size of the amendment.
Yeah, copying budget becomes, that's part of the reason why we have it all in OLIS and all ready to review in OLIS. And I think I asked you if you would prepare an errata sheet showing the key differences between the dash two and the other amendments that that Senator Haas has asked for. I think that makes it, for those who have actually marked up the dash two, it makes it easier to review the other piece. Colleagues, given the schedule, we really need to move on this matter and get it out to the floors very quickly. And so we will meet on Monday at 8:30. The House committee is meeting this afternoon at 1 o'clock. We have several matters. I'm sorry, 2 o'clock. I think it's posted for 1, but in fact, and we'll leave it there because we never know what the House is going to do. But the House currently plans to meet at 1. And so we will plan to meet immediately after the House adjourns for an hour or until we finish our business for the day. Senator Haas, did you have other scheduling announcements?
No. The Joint Tax Committee on Friday.
Oh, yes. The Joint Tax Credit Committee meets Friday at 1 o'clock. Thank you. And we hope to have a bill for you then, or at least a getting close.
Amendment, yes.
All right. And with that,
please.
With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2830, and the committee's adjourned. Committee's adjourned. On House Bill 2830, and